Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For more than 20 years, Naomi Klein has been the foremost chronicler of the economic war waged on both people and the planet, and an unapologetic champion of a sweeping environmental agenda with justice at its center. In her latest book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, she reports from the front lines of contemporary natural disaster, presenting prescient advisories and dire warnings of what future awaits us if we refuse to act, as well as hopeful glimpses of what a far better future can look like. Today we air an interview I conducted with Naomi Klein on September 25th, while she was in Portland speaking at Powell's Books. After the interview, we'll hear some clips of speeches and music recorded at a couple recent rallies at Washington's Department of Ecology and at the state capitol, calling on the state agencies and elected officials, especially Governor Jay Inslee, to act on their lofty rhetoric and stop the proposed methanol refinery and LNG facility from being built in Kalama and Tacoma. I'm talking this afternoon with Naomi Klein, who has written many books, but her most recent book is called On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it means to have our house on fire. That was a sign that we saw a lot of the climate march on Friday held by these young people. So what does it mean when people say our house is on fire?
Well, they're talking about the fact that our planet is warming, that we've increased the average temperatures by 1 degree Celsius. We are on track, if we continue with business as usual, to increase temperatures by 4 to 6 degrees Celsius. In order to get to that future, which is just unlivable, which is really incompatible with anything you would define as a human civilization, is just all we have to do is just nothing. Like, we just have to keep on just being us and doing what we're doing and failing to act like the house is on fire and acting like we are in an emergency. So I think when young people hold those signs that say the house is on fire, or when Greta Thunberg talks about the fact that we are in an emergency and we need the political class to act like it, I think what they're saying is that when we understand ourselves to be in a true emergency, we do different things. We are able to, to achieve some pretty amazing feats. We access the sort of the superpowers associated with survival, and we haven't done that when it comes to the climate crisis. We've heard lots of good speeches, and even before the U.S. had a president who denied the reality of climate change, there were successive presidents that made lots of good speeches about how serious this was, and yet continued to roll out fossil fuel infrastructure, and emissions in the United States rose, and they continue to rise globally. So no matter how many UN summits we have, no matter how much we hear from politicians about how serious they understand the crisis to be, we simply aren't acting like it.
You start your book out with talking about Greta Thunberg, the amazing young climate activist from Sweden. Well, she's here in the United States and has been the center of a lot of media attention for the last couple of weeks. So I wanted to talk about her and why is she able to shake up so much?
You know, frankly, I'm a little bit worried at how much a focus is just on Greta. In the book, I don't just write about Greta. I write about the global movement of young people that has emerged around the world. Every Friday now, there are thousands of young people who walk out of their classes. They were inspired by a protest that Greta began. But this is a movement that is that has many leaders, that has many really, really powerful young people, some even younger than Greta. Think about like Haven Coleman in Colorado here, just 13 years old, who started going on climate strike. Alexandria Villaseñor in New York City, who's been having a weekly vigil outside the United Nations. And young people are bringing their terror, their raw terror about what they're learning in school, about what they're seeing in nature documentaries, about what is happening to our planet, and saying, well, wait a minute, how do you expect me to just sort of obediently prepare for the future when I'm simultaneously given to understand that my future may actually be one in which I'm just running away from disasters. How can we plan? How can we believe that the future matters when the adults with power are doing nothing to safeguard the basics of a stable future, a habitable climate? So Greta is one voice. There are many other voices. There are powerful indigenous young people in the United States who inspired Greta. I worry about how much it is being personalized on her, although I adore her and I believe her to be an incredibly prophetic voice. I still think that we should question why so many other voices aren't being listened to.
Actually, I think that Greta has the best answer to that, because I've just heard her several times, like, deflecting the iconization that the media is trying to do of her, particularly about her life being threatened. She's saying, no, my life is not threatened. It might be, you know, trolled. There are so many environmental activists around the world who have been killed. And for her, at the age of 15, to understand that.
16, yeah.
She's 16 now. I think mm-hmm. she was 15 when she said that.
Yeah.
And I think she gets things. She understands things in a way that so many adults don't understand them.
Yeah, she gets that she's one of the lucky ones. I think one of the reasons why Greta has had such powerful moral clarity and has inspired so many others to find their voice, you know, she talks about neurodiversity and her autism diagnosis, and how she, as she says, sees the world in black and white. I don't know a child in the world who, when you tell them about ecological crisis, not even necessarily climate change, just maybe plastic in the ocean, they just want to fix it. First of all, they're horrified, and then they're like, okay, well, we have to fix it. You know, we have to stop polluting. We have to get the plastic out of the ocean. I mean, the kids are natural problem solvers. They understand that, you know, we have to act. You know, they don't say, like, how can we put a price on carbon and, you know, have some offsets? I mean, adults overcomplicate this. Kids get it. But I think what makes Greta different is that, and this is, you know, this is in her words, she says, I'm not interested in your social games. I think, like many, many people on the autism spectrum, she has her focus. It's not that she doesn't see, you know, what others are doing, but she's not imitating other people. And so I think that that is what allowed her to stay with her original instinct, whereas I think a lot of us have that original instinct, but then we look around and nobody else is acting like it's an emergency, so maybe it's not so bad. We take our social cues from each other, whereas Greta looked around and said, you guys are nuts. You know, like, why is everybody acting like the house isn't on fire when clearly the house is on fire? I think she's a really important leader.
Well, actually, on Monday, I was heading up to this rally in front of the Department of Ecology in Washington State, where they have what I'm sure Greta would think, and a lot of us think, is a very clear-cut option. They can either deny a permit for the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, which is proposed for Kalama, or they can allow it to be built. And there seems to be no answer. And we see that they have the full authority as part of their portfolio in the state of Washington is to protect the environment. And after I came back from the rally, I had gotten an email with a link to Greta's speech at the UN that morning and her, how dare they? How dare you? And I thought, I wish we'd had her there, because though actually we had some pretty powerful people, though there were not any youth at that rally, but people were addressing that. And I felt like in a way she sums up that sentiment of what is taking so long? Why is it so complicated? And I wonder how we run with that.
And she also talks about, you know, the fairy tale of endless growth. I think that her analysis is, you know, the reason why we don't have the political leadership that we need is because political leaders are locked within an economic model that defines success as endless growth. And that is just not compatible with, having global emissions in a little bit more than a decade, because that's going to require some contraction. That's going to require consuming less, those of us who overconsume. So if we have an economic system that defines success as continuing the ever-expanding consumption of disposable goods, we've got a problem. That's pretty obvious. But it's amazing how resistant people are. Maybe it's not amazing. I mean, this is what it means to be locked within an economic logic.
Well, she talks a lot about basically what you would call the end of capitalism. I mean, she's saying basically our system doesn't work the way it works. It has all the wrong priorities. And you have a chapter in your book, which is, I think, Climate Versus Capitalism. And I thought as I was reading it today that in a lot of ways it's laying out in more detail some of the things that Greta was saying at the UN on Monday. So let's talk about this inherent contradiction between actually addressing climate change in any realistic and productive way and the role of capitalism in actually perpetuating what's the problem that we're trying to address.
Right. So I think we have this basic conflict between the quest for endless growth on a finite planet and the fact that we need to contract our exhaustion of nature. We need to, we can extract from nature, but we also need to respect the cycles of replenishing, regeneration. And that's a basic conflict. But we've also had a kind of more immediate conflict with the kind of capitalism that has dominated throughout the entire period that we have been talking about lowering emissions. And governments have been meeting to talk about the climate crisis since 1988. That was the first year, the first intergovernmental meeting. That's the year that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed. Eventually, this leading to the UN Climate Convention. And so, you know, if we think about what else was happening in 1988, 1989, in this key period, well, the Berlin Wall collapsed. The first free trade agreement was signed between Canada and the United States in 1988. Francis Fukuyama declared the end of history. Margaret Thatcher told us there was no alternative. Ronald Reagan told us that the 9 most dangerous words in the English language were, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." So there was a war, an ideological war being waged on the very idea of the collective, of the public. We were told that the role of government was just to get out of the way of corporations and the rich so that they could create wealth and everything, the benefits would trickle down to everyone else. And the tenets of this project were privatization of the public sphere, deregulation of the corporate sphere, low corporate taxes paid for by slashing social services. Then think about what we need to do in the face of the climate crisis. Massive investments in the public sphere to get off fossil fuels, planning and managing our economy, telling corporations that no, they can't dig up all the carbon underground and treat the atmosphere as their garbage can. All of this flies in the face of the basic tenets of the sort of free market revolution that we've been living, which itself was a counter-revolution against the original New Deal, right? You know, in when I wrote The Shock Doctrine, I quoted Milton Friedman saying that, you know, the things went wrong in this country when people got the idea that they could do good things with other people's money. He believed that the way to do good things was to just let people shop as much as possible and the collective benefits would trickle down. Well, you can't solve climate change within that framework. And that's why I think we are in a really interesting political moment and why there is a real shift underway. It's not just because there were lots of young people in the streets having a protest. It's because if you talk to those young people, they have lost faith. So many of them have lost faith in this economic system, not just because of climate change, but because of job precariousness, because they cannot imagine that they'd ever be able to own a house because of gentrification, because, you know, the utopian promises of the tech industry have given way to online harassment and constant surveillance. All of these systemic failures within capitalism. So, you know, these are the young people whose entire, like, conscious lives have happened in the aftermath of the economic crash of 2008, 2009. So they have a much greater appetite for system change than my generation. who got the sort of neoliberal hard sell, right? And all the promises. Like, all they know is, well, we bailed out the banks. Why can't we bail out the planet? This system is failing us on multiple fronts. Why don't we try a different system? So they're a lot less conservative, really. And I find that really exciting.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to an interview I conducted with Naomi Klein, author of a new book, On Fire. I talked with her on September 25th.
I had this strong hit when I was at the climate strike march on Friday. I felt like I've been here before. This is the middle of a youth-led movement with all this youthful energy. And then there were quite a few older people as well, but definitely youth-led. And I thought, well, the last time I was in a movement like this was when I was in college. We were fighting the Vietnam War. I mean, we were fighting to stop the Vietnam War. And I started thinking about that power of youth and how, as I got older, got out of college, got a little older, and realized things aren't going to be so easy to change as I thought they were when I was a fiery young radical. But one of the things that stuck with me and a lot of people of my generation is that we recognized the fallacy of capitalism back in the late 60s. And that was a big part of the left in the late 60s and the 70s. So I'm interested that you see that the young people now are coming back to that understanding. I wonder.
We're only talking about a Green New Deal because a democratic socialist, you know, who is just a little bit older than the young people in the streets, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, you know, before she was even sworn in, supported the Sunrise Movement when they occupied the office of Nancy Pelosi. She visited them and, you know, said, we're going to get the Green New Deal done. And it was her and it was Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley, the squad. You know, we have a generation of insurgent Democrats who are not following the leadership of their party, who are really determined to do what their communities need, and they represent some of the most impoverished communities in the United States. They're not afraid to marry bold climate action with economic justice and racial justice, And that's the game changer, you know. Now here we are, you know, in a Democratic primary, where we have several of the leading candidates endorsing an intersectional, bold Green New Deal. There's differences certainly between what Bernie is proposing, what Elizabeth Warren is proposing, you know, what Kamala Harris means when she talks about a Green New Deal, but what these young people have done is they've redrawn the political map already in just a matter of months.
Actually, they're doing what we couldn't do 40, 50 years ago. I mean, it's interesting that there's something different about now, and maybe it has to do with there's so many places, so many parts of the world and the planet seem to be falling apart, that there's an urgency that they had that we didn't even have back when I was their age.
Well, because they're not just dealing with the climate fires. They're dealing with the fires of fascism. They're dealing with the rise, you know, of unmasked white supremacy. They understand that the center's collapse and the failure of sort of establishment democratic politics, the failure to speak to working people's pain, created a political vacuum that the far right is entering into. And so they have an incredible sense of moral urgency, not just the urgency of understanding we have a decade to radically lower emissions, but they have an incredible sense of moral urgency to be a real alternative to this politics of hate. You know what, we have three fires right now. We've got the climate fires, we've got the fires of fascism, and then we have our fires, which are the fires of these growing movements. And, you know, you mentioned the 60s and a youth movement, and they are a youth movement, but they're calling on adults to join them. And I think that's one of the things that makes them most interesting is it isn't don't trust anyone over 30. They don't want to just be a youth movement. They want an intergenerational movement. They're not letting the adults off the hook. There's nothing they hate more than having, you know, their heads patted and told that, you know, we're giving them hope. They're like, no, join us, do your job. And I think it's really important because I think, you know, some of the failures of the 60s youth movement had to do with the sort of shelf life of equating radicalism with youth, and the isolation that happens when you don't have an intergenerational movement. And, you know, I've had the privilege of working with, you know, some really powerful indigenous-led movements in Canada, you know, and in the U.S. at Standing Rock. And, you know, what makes those movements powerful is that they are intergenerational, that they have that fire of young people willing to take risks. But there's also a role for elders, a really powerful role for elders. And I think that's important. I think that's how we build movements that last.
One of the things that I was hearing a lot at the rallies I was at in Washington yesterday and on Monday was the big difference between the power structure in this country and how it operates and Indigenous people is that Indigenous people view their leaders as women elders, and that's who really has the final word. And of course, in our mainstream culture, women elders are completely disregarded and
disposed
scorned.
Of. Mm-hmm. And more disposable people in a disposable culture. Mm-hmm.
And that's like really apparent when you're around. And a lot of the actions now in this region and around the country, from what I understand, are really being led by Indigenous people. One thing I really appreciated at the Climate March on Friday was how many young people of color were speaking, and particularly the Pacific Islanders, mm-hmm. who are directly impacted. Their homes are directly impacted. Yeah. And how do you see that that connects? I mean, you talk about the intersectionalism of all this. How, in bringing in the voices and the leadership of Indigenous young people, how does that change this movement and make it possibly more effective?
Right. Well, I think that the movement will be most effective if it is led by the people who have the most to gain from change. You know, I think a big part of where we went wrong in the climate movement was it was led by people who were being pretty well served by this current system. I think I'm one of those people. I'm pretty well served by this system. I'm doing okay. Al Gore is doing pretty okay. Leonardo DiCaprio is doing pretty okay. The problem with that, right, is that, you know, the big green groups, you know, are overwhelmingly middle class and so on. If things are pretty much okay for you, then when you look at the climate crisis, you're going to ask, well, what's the least we can do, right? You know, if you think about the whole framing of the inconvenient truth, it's basically like everything is okay except for this inconvenient truth that we've put all this carbon into the atmosphere. Now, if you are in a frontline community, right, and that's in this country that's overwhelmingly Black, Indigenous, immigrant communities that have had their lands ravaged by fossil fuel extraction, have been treated like sacrifice zones. They have the dirty industries in their backyards. Their bodies are bearing the toxic burden of this economic model. Faced with the climate crisis, the question is not what's the least that can change? what's the least we can do? Like, can we get away just with changing our light bulbs? No, I mean, if we can have deep change that is going to bring jobs, that is going to bring justice, that is going to close the systemic gap, systemic equality gaps in this country that so closely follow racial fault lines, then you're going to want to fight for that future because it's going to be better than your present, right? So, you know, I think that there's a bunch of different reasons why it's important to hear the voices of people in frontline communities like Greta. They bring that sense of existential urgency. Young people right now are bringing that. You know, as a generation, they're saying this is my future. But you know, if it is your land that is being ravaged by tar sands mining or coal mining, or is, you know, facing, you know, disappearing beneath the waves, you mentioned, you know, Pacific Islanders, then you're going to be speaking about this crisis in a very, very different way that's going to touch people, that's going to reach people in a way that the sort of parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere is not going to reach them. So I think the urgency is important. But I think just strategically, this is the fight of our lives. And this is not a fight that doesn't have enemies. This fight has enemies. And the enemies are fossil fuel companies and the banks that fund them that fight us every step of the way, even when we try to introduce the most sort of modest carbon pricing. They throw everything at it, right? So I think the question that we have is, how are we going to build the biggest and most determined you know, movement that will fight like hell against those forces. And I think that the people who fight like hell are the people who are fighting for their lives, the people who have the most to gain from change because their lives depend on it. Their kids' health depends on it, that bring that sense of existential urgency.
Well, you made a reference to an inconvenient truth. Most people think of Al Gore's movie when you use that phrase, but you talk about another inconvenient truth.
Which the one about
it has to do with the Heartland Institute and how they view the right. The commie threat of the climate movement.
Right. So, I mean, I think if we want to understand why climate change denial is so strong on the right of the political spectrum and why people who hold sort of hard right views, you know, they think that, you know, we should just get out of the way of corporations and the rich so that they can, you know, make all the money that will trickle down, et cetera, who are comfortable with high levels of inequality and so on. Those are the people who overwhelmingly deny the reality of climate change. And it isn't because, you know, they're not scientists. They're not motivated by concern about the science. This all comes from right-wing think tanks like the Heartland Institute, which is a, you know, so-called free market think tank. And you know, when I interviewed the head of the Heartland Institute some years ago, he was very frank about this. He said that he realized that if the science was true, then it would be the biggest gift to the left. They would be able to justify any kind of market intervention. And he said, so I took another look at the science. So, you know, what I'm arguing is that in some ways, the right understands the implications of the climate crisis better than sort of centrist liberals who have been telling us, oh, yes, the science is true, but we can fix it with these little tweaks, a little few cap and trade here and changing our light bulbs and so on. Actually, we can't. It requires a much more fundamental change to our economic structure. The right gets this, and that's why they've been denying the science so vociferously, because they understand that their whole ideological project falls apart, because of course we need to regulate corporations, of course we need to invest in the public sphere, and we're going to have to pay for that somewhere, so they're going to have their taxes increased, and on and on and on.
I'm thinking about how many conversations I've had over my life about overthrowing capitalism and overthrowing imperialism, and it's interesting that now is actually seems to be a better opportunity to really look at that and to see what it really means, and to be having Bernie Sanders trying to define socialism to people who don't understand what it is. Mm-hmm. And that this is, what kind of opportunity do you see for us to really use this moment and the climate crisis to really work towards a just society?
So look, I'm a writer. So I believe in deadlines. You know, I think deadlines can be really helpful, and boy, we've got a tight deadline. So, you know, I think that if the only crisis we faced within capitalism was climate change, we'd be cooked, because I don't think that people will overthrow an economic system that is working for them because of concern about the environment. But I do think that if you look at all of the different ways in which this economic system is failing the majority of people, and we can connect those failures, those daily failures, you know, the lack of healthcare, the lack of ever more economic precarity, the lack of job security, you know, unaffordable education, crumbling infrastructure, the rest of it. If we can connect those crises and more, you know, including the less tangible ones, you know, an epidemic of despair, the opioid crisis, you know, these indicators that show that, you know, all is not well, the system is not sitting well with people, really a spiritual crisis. If we can connect that and say, and on top of that, this economic system is on track to make the planet uninhabitable, and P.S., it put us on a deadline, so we've got to change quickly. That's the recipe, I think, that works. Not just like, oh, climate change is going to scare us into this. We have to understand the way all of these crises are interrelated, have their roots in this similar drive that treats both people and planet as if they are disposable. And that, I think, has our best chance of catalyzing that shift. I don't think our chances are good. I think it is a long shot. But I think so long as there's any chance that we could seize this moment and turn things around in this narrow window, then this is an all hands on deck moment. You know, this is why I have so little patience for the sort of hand wringing of the Jonathan Franzens and the doomers, the doomer dudes, as one of my friends calls them. You know, they're just like, oh, it's all too late. We're all too selfish. There is a shift going on there. And And the fact that there is, you know, a growing democratic socialist movement in this country, that we are seeing the center move within the Democratic Party significantly to the left, all of this is reason for hope, and all of this is, you know, reason to work with everything we have to improve our chances.
If you're just tuning in and you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and today we're listening to an interview I conducted with Naomi Klein, author of a new book called On Fire, and I recorded it on September 25th.
Well, you mentioned sort of a spiritual shift, and you have a chapter in the book called, I think it's called A Hole in the Earth.
Hole in the World.
Hole in the World. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of inspired by the BP Deepwater Horizon catastrophe.
Yeah.
But you talk about the mentality that started a few hundred years ago, where people no longer related to the earth as a living system mm-hmm. and as full of spirits that could actually affect their lives if they don't treat them well, to a commodity that can be controlled and reshaped in the human image. I've just come from 2 days spending a lot of time with indigenous people who are talking about their connection to the earth, and it goes deep. It goes way, way deep, and they are bringing up that power, confronting the Department of Ecology in Washington, confronting Governor Inslee, who says one thing but still not doing what he says he should be doing. Mm-hmm. And I was really getting that feeling yesterday of just how deep that connection is. Let's talk a little bit about the disconnect mm-hmm. and how we get back to reconnecting.
Well, the book is dedicated to a man named Arthur Emanuel, who was a mentor of mine. He died in 2017. He was a really important Indigenous leader in Canada from the Sequimuc First Nation in British Columbia. And Arthur was absolutely convinced that the only way out of this ecological crisis was a revolution in respect for Indigenous land rights and knowledge, for Indigenous knowledge. A year before he died, he had a gathering on his traditional territory with a lot of Indigenous elders, which was discussing both the need to stop a huge tar sands pipeline that would going to be running through their territory, the Kinder Morgan expansion, but also how to spread Indigenous knowledge in a way that could reach people. And it was really interesting because a lot of the older women at that gathering had such a sense of urgency about people needing to understand this other way of seeing the earth, that we are not the boss in this rigid hierarchy, that we are in a community of living creatures, and that if we could understand this different way of knowing, that we would have a pathway out of this crisis. One of the things that I think it would be really promising as part of a Green New Deal would be to think, okay, well, we know that we have to pull a lot of carbon out of the air. It's not just about getting to 100% renewable energy. We are over 450 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We need to draw carbon down. And one of the ways to do that is to plant a whole lot of trees and restore wetlands and, you know, do a great deal of land rehabilitation. Under the original New Deal, you know, FDR had the Civilian Conservation Corps, which had hundreds of camps spread out across the United States. They planted 2.3 billion trees, which is more than half the trees ever planted in the United States. And we do need a reforestation on that level right now. What about if that process was intimately connected to Indigenous land rights and was informed and led by, you know, Indigenous knowledge? What if these sort of imperatives were married? And, you know, I think that could be should be a really important part of the discussion that we're having about a Green New Deal in this country.
Well, I keep having the image of last summer. There was an orca named Telequa whose calf died, and she spent 17 days circling the Salish Sea, pushing the calf in front of her, and going to every population center along the Salish Sea. She wasn't out in the middle of it where nobody could see it, and she was crying out to listen. And it wasn't just to listen to her, but for us to be able to connect, to listen to the planet and what the planet's going through. Mm-hmm. And I had several conversations last summer with people who were talking about the ways that animals consciously communicate with us. Mm-hmm. And it's a real powerful thing when you listen to them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how we can carry that image of Tahlequah with us now. I mean, and last summer was also the summer of the fires, much worse fires than you describe in your book. Mm-hmm. And it was such an intense time, and people were very, very freaked out, really, especially when the fires just went on and on and on. It was so smoky in the Northwest. And somehow I felt like that image gave me some hope. And I wonder if you see that, like connecting with Tahlequah, what you mm-hmm. can feel about what we learn when we listen to the whales.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I found it so painful. And just that grief. You know, I think it just speaks to the fact that this is a planet in pain. And maybe it can help us access some of our own pain, because I think that one of the mistakes we make in the climate movement is we don't leave enough room for grief. We sort of expect to give people really terrifying information and then for them to instantly turn into activists. And we sort of skip the part where we actually feel the fear and the terror and grief and the loss that it's too late to fix, you know. And you know, I just think that it is so important for us to have love for what we're fighting for in the movements that we build, because there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of grief, there's a lot of anger, and it's all valid and they're all useful emotions. But I think what will keep us in this is a connection to what we're fighting for, the people we love, and the places we love, and our desire to be, you know, in the company of other living beings. You know, when I think about the loneliness, you know, and we've also been hearing some terrifying things about the loss of bird life. I mean, really, the sort of the fulfillment of Rachel Carson's predictions about a silent spring, and just the loneliness of being of what we are doing. I think we so often as humans underestimate the comforts that we get from being in the company of other species, even if we don't notice them, whether it's bird song or, you know. My family's in British Columbia, so you know, I know for my son, he's obsessed with salmon. He's completely obsessed with salmon. It's how he understands ecology, right? Is that he's read so many books about how the salmon, you know, feed the forests and feed the oceans, and you know, ancient cultures rest on these incredibly generous creatures. And so we just have to carry with us what we're fighting for, and I think that one of the most dangerous things that happens in an era of climate disruption is that nature comes to be equated with fear, right? Like we're talking about all of these terrifying things, and I think we need to remember that nature is not our enemy. Like what we are experiencing is the effects of our having disrupted the elements of digging up, you know, the digging up interred life from the earth and putting it in the sky where it doesn't belong and into the oceans. And so what we're seeing with these superstorms and droughts and these extreme weather events, this is our actions, not nature's actions. And so I think it's really important to stay in touch with the fact that nature's not our enemy. And I think we have a right to nature. Everyone has a right to nature, and we need to democratize that right. You know, there's this sort of idea that, oh, access to nature is like a middle-class concern, but I think what we need to do is fight for everybody's right to have access to nature.
Well, I feel real gifted because of where I live is right near a wildlife refuge, and so we have a lot of birds in our yard, and last summer, I was working on this fossil fuel project and living, you know, in this kind of gruesome reality a lot of times as I'm dealing with this. But I went out in the backyard just around sunset, and it turns out we had a family of hummingbirds that had grown up in the front of our yard. And they were playing. There were four of them, and they were just having, like, the family outing before sunset, playing, and they were coming up to me and, you know, buzzing right in front of my face, and I was part of the game. And it was an amazing experience to, like, to interact with hummingbirds that way. They're my favorite species anyway. Special thing for them. They stayed with me all summer, especially as I was struggling with all the fossil fuel projects that we're trying to fight in the Northwest, and remembering that the hummingbirds are our friends. And in a way, I think they were giving me a message. It was a different kind of message than Telequaz, but it was maybe on the other side of still remembering the importance of the connection with nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to carve out time in our lives to have those experiences, because they're incredibly sustaining.
Well, one last thing I want to talk about with you today is about fire. Your book is called On Fire, mm-hmm. and you describe your experience of coming back for a wonderful summer vacation in beautiful British Columbia to experience, up until that point, the worst fires. They got worse the next year. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about that whole experience of those of us in the Northwest who have lived, actually, it's been like three out of the last four summers yeah. where we've been inundated with smoke. And in 2017, you just kind of made a brief reference to the Columbia Gorge fire mm-hmm. in Eagle Creek, which was really intense here.
Yeah.
But that was the year, I think, that Portland really experienced what it's like to have the world on fire, because that mm-hmm. fire came really close to the city.
Yeah.
But let's talk about, first of all, your personal experience of, like, thinking you're going to go on a vacation to one of the most beautiful places in the world, and you had to smell smoke for however long you were there, and then sort of extrapolated into this whole reality that we have, that the world is on fire, literally.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about the smoke, because it isn't an extreme experience. It's not like living through a Category 5 hurricane, you know, or being in the middle of a wildfire. It's just this relentless blanket that just wears you down. And, you know, you sort of have these kind of like minor symptoms, and yet it just went on and wore on for so long. And the amount of territory it covered, you know, that plume of smoke reached from the Atlantic to the Pacific at certain points. And for me, it was sort of like also kind of like a metaphor where people were sort of determined to have their summer vacations anyway. And you know, we're sort of like paddling into the smoke and you know, drinking beers on the beach in the smoke and just trying to pretend like everything was normal. And there was a, you know, I would just kind of see myself from the outside and just realize, like, we really are, you know, just kind of sleepwalking to the apocalypse. And that, you know, desire to just act like the house isn't on fire when it is, it's so powerful. And nobody around you is acting like there's anything wrong with it. And, you know, Justin Trudeau came to visit BC and, you know, announced that he was going ahead with the tripling of the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And, you know, and I think once again, buying it later. Yeah. So determined he went and bought it. So, it's not to say that this is like the worst kind of climate disaster, but there's something about it. And I do think that more and more of us have very direct experience with climate disruption now, whether it's the wildfires here, you know, or whether it's flooding in the center of the country, or whether it's the storms, you know, on the Gulf Coast, or whether it's the heat waves on the East Coast. This is not a future crisis. This is not an abstraction. People are in it, and we have it vastly easier than people in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, and people who are being forced to move and are trying to get into this country because their, you know, plot of land in, you know, Guatemala or Honduras, you know, no longer yields crops because they're in the fifth year of a drought, or people in the Bahamas, you know, who not only had a Cat 5 hurricane over their island, but it just sat there and just parked there seemingly forever, just churning through the island. And then when people finally were able to get on a boat to head to the United States to try to find some safety for their families, the boat was turned back and they had to hear, you know, President Trump talk about them as like bad people and drug dealers trying to get into our country. We're in it, you know. So we are all alive in a moment in history where we have a very, very short window to achieve some huge things. And it's not just that the world's on fire, it's also that the arsonists are in charge. They're in charge in the United States. They're in charge in Brazil. They're in charge in India. They are pitting us against each other in a systemic way so that they are free to plunder the last remaining wildernesses of this planet. And in light of those fires, those intersecting fires that are fueling each other, we have to find a third fire. Like, we have to really be part of a third fire that is absolutely determined, you know, not just to have a protest, not just to raise an issue, but to win, you know, to actually unseat these arsonists, and to put in place a serious fire safety plan. And that's what I think the Green New Deal is. And we have to fight for it to get better and bolder and more ambitious. But, you know, everything is on the line right now.
So I've been talking with Naomi Klein, who's the author of a new book on fire. And we've just been trying to get you to be on fire, too. So thanks for joining us, Naomi.
It was such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We just heard an interview I conducted with Naomi Klein on September 25th. Now we'll hear some excerpts from speeches given on September 23rd in front of the Washington Department of Ecology office in Lacey and October 5th on the steps of the Washington State Capitol, two rallies calling on Washington State's agencies and governor to declare a climate emergency and stop the world's largest methanol refinery from being built in Kalama and a complex LNG facility from being built at the Port of Tacoma. We'll hear from John Flynn, a Kalama resident who is running for city council, Bill Kapinski, a professor at the University of Puget Sound, and Paul Chioctin, founder of the Protectors of the Salish Sea, who organized a four-day walk from the Tacoma LNG tank to the state capitol, where the water protectors are still holding space after 3 weeks. I'd also like to note that these protests are beginning to pay off. On October 9th, the Washington Department of Ecology refused to issue a key permit for the proposed Kalama methanol refinery, instead requesting more information about the project's climate pollution. Without the Department of Ecology's approval, the proposal for the world's largest frack gas to methanol refinery cannot proceed. And now we're going to go to Lacey, Washington on September 23rd.
My name is John Flynn. My wife Teresa and I live in Kalama. We're a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese government called Northwest Innovation Works, is proposing to build the world's largest fracked methane gas to methanol refinery on the banks of the Columbia River.
Shut it down!
As a resident of Kalama, as a recreational fisherman, and as a candidate for city council,
yeah,
I am adamantly opposed to this project, not only on environmental grounds, but also for depriving us of our basic human rights to clean air, clean water, and the pursuit of our lives. We are here today to emphatically ask the Department of Ecology to deny the shoreline permit for the construction of this proposed refinery. NWIW has been caught red-handed lying about the end use of their paraduct. They have told public and state regulators that their methanol would be used in the production of more plastic, which we do not need, while documentation has emerged that they have told potential investors their methanol would be used as fuel. That lack of transparency alone, to my mind, is grounds to deny the permit. This project, with its gluttonous use of methane gas, water, and electricity, would lock us into 40 years of climate-changing pollution. We do not have 40 years to transition away from fossil fuel consumption in order to save our planet and our species, let alone all those other species that depend upon clean air and clean water to survive. To quote Governor Inslee, scientific reality demands that we put an end to new fossil fuel development. The upstream, direct, and downstream greenhouse gas emissions from this refinery could potentially be as much as 12 million metric tons combined annually. We must stop this environmental piracy by the fossil fuel industry. We must prevent Kalama from becoming a sacrifice zone for the benefit of foreign corporate profit.
That's right.
We ask the Department of Ecology to have the moral courage to do the right thing for our city, our state, and our planet. Deny this permit. NWIW, not what I want. Say no to fracked gas. Thank you.
I've lived in Tacoma for 17 years now, and during the last few years, I've watched this horrifying transformation where our port of Tacoma has had a kind of arms race to build as much fossil fuel infrastructure as possible. First, the world's largest methanol plant, which we defeated and which we're going to defeat in Kalama as well. But now we're fighting all sorts of fossil fuel expansion down at the Port of Tacoma. We're fighting oil refining, we're fighting oil trains, and we're fighting a methanol plant that has been built without its necessary permits. Every single member of the Tacoma City Council has received money from Puget Sound Energy. We do not have a functioning democracy in Tacoma, Washington right now. They cannot be in charge. They cannot be the lead agency. They are not an impartial party. You need to reclaim this from them now. If you're the Department of Ecology, I believe that you came to your jobs because you want to do good. I believe that you care about this world. I believe that you care about people in Washington, people in this continent, people in Turtle Island, people in this planet. But to do that, you're gonna have to say no sometime. You issue permits because there should be the possibility that a project is so dangerous and it is so outrageous and it is so bad that you say no. And with this project, you are going to be poisoning the water of communities far away, poor communities, indigenous communities. You are going to be creating an environmental hazard a few feet above sea level on the traditional lands of the Puyallup Nation in what was one of the most rich and biodiverse areas in the world. You're going to be doing it a couple of miles away from people who are imprisoned in the Northwest Detention Center, a privately run immigration prison. You'll be polluting the air. You'll be leaking methane 86 times more powerful than CO2 over a 20-year period. You will be contributing to the climate crisis. If there was ever a project to say no to, it is this project now. We need you to say no. We are asking for your help now. Help us, please. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. We need you. We need you on our side. We will back you up. We want you on our side. We want to work together. Thank you.
This colonial government has been here for a blink of an eye in our long tens of thousands of years of history here under indigenous natural law. The will of no white patriarch, colonial, will ever alter natural law in the most minuscule form because they've never worked inside of natural law here since the first footstep. I'm referring to a government that pushed its will on everybody who is on our lands and waters. Our people would not do anything unless the spirit showed it to us. And then we would counsel about that. And then the last tier of counseling to decide if that was really shown to us and that was something that we would do as a people, as a society, was a council of elder life bringers, my family. The women get that medicine all over them and now they understand the circle of life in a very intimate and strong way. And now they stand up fiercely for life. That's the role of the life bringer, to guide society. We never killed one of those ancient cedar trees. 95% of them annihilated in the Salish Sea bioregion. 95% of natural animals completely wiped from the water and the lands here in our Salish Sea. And 95% of indigenous human beings annihilated here. And if they don't look at their direction, if they refuse to look at where they come from, then I do not want to witness the future that they will create. Our old people, they stand in front of the house even today and they say, if you know where you come from, you will know where you are going. You know, we come from elder councils of women guiding us fiercely towards life in every single thing, respected every family down to a group of medicine plants and a sacred promise to them, a sacred promise to every family. That's where we come from. When I speak to Tacoma City Council to stop LNG on Puyallup's estuary, I told them, you people inside these governmental buildings, you've never ever had the strength to look at where you come from. And I tell them exactly what I just told you about the annihilation of everything that we've loved here. And I said, that's where you come from. And if you refuse to look at that, you'll continue in that direction until you take the lives of our children and your children. And you have to look at your direction. You have to realize that you're still going for it harder than ever. You're going for it harder than ever with the increase of all these fossil fuel expansions, trying to create a hub here in our Salish Sea. You're moving towards it faster and harder than ever. And you've only been here in the blink of an eye. And you've already wiped out most everything that we've ever loved here. And it's unacceptable anymore. It is absolutely unacceptable. And what we need to do today is come together. Our old people prophesied this time when we must open our mouth. The ancient teachings of our first peoples on Turtle Island will save this world. And they've gotten out there, and the youth now know who they are. They've become better leaders, stronger, more informed, and more mature, more adult than the adults inside these concrete cash registers. And if Jay Inslee cannot listen to his own children cry out, give us a future, millions and millions and millions of them crying out, give us a future. If they can't hear that as a dying world stares them in the eyes, the beginning of that era, then what will they listen to? As they grasp onto their power, as they grasp on to creating an infrastructure that we will not be able to get free of in time.
We just heard speeches before the Washington Department of Ecology and State Capitol delivered on September 25th, 3rd, and October 5th. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KPFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any other of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll hear the first hour of my new documentary, Holding the Thin Green Line, which features all the people you just heard speak at the rallies today, plus many more activists from Tacoma and Kalama who are working to stop the Kalama Methanol Refinery and Tacoma LNG. On October 28th, we'll air the second hour, which tells the story of the 15-year struggle to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export facility and Pacific Connector gas pipeline. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're listening to some music that was being played at the steps of the state capitol on October 5th in Washington. Thanks for listening.